everybody, it's Mittens with another episode of Supernatural George. Today we'll be discussing Season 2, Episode 8, Crossroad Blues, written by Sarah Gamble and directed by Steve Boyum. This is his first episode, but by no means will be his last. He's going to go on to direct some pretty groundbreaking and memorable episodes. I mean, he directed The End, Season 5, Episode 4, and Season 5, Episode 22, Swan Song. So he only directed about 10 episodes, but man, he directed some really big ones. At any rate, let us move on to today's episode. Crossroad Blues, our first real introduction to what a proper Crossroads demon is. We've seen one demon deal between John and Azazel, but that wasn't really a Crossroads demon deal. We'll learn that there is a specific type of demon who does these sorts of deals and that there are rules attached and involved. This episode, we also have some of the casting sides for, which shed a little bit of light on changes that were actually made between the time that these casting sides came out, which is the writer's draft dated September 7th, 2006, and the aired version of the show, which obviously this isn't even a production draft. This is pre-production draft, and production drafts even get edited as production begins. So this was a very early draft. The casting sides for the demon, the Crossroads demon that Dean interacts with, are interesting because there's a few things that she says in the aired version that are not in the writer's draft script. One of them that was bothering me so much today, I actually put it up on the Discord server and promising to talk about it when I recorded this, is the line that she says about how Dean was supposed to be dead and John was supposed to be alive. That's not in the writer's draft about how Dean and Sam and John could have 10 long years as a family together. That's not in the writer's draft. There's none of that deeper context, and we'll get into that when we get to that scene a little more, but I just find it interesting that that was something that was added to just pile some more guilt on Dean that he should have been dead. Like he's been saying all season long, you know, what's dead should stay dead, and he feels that about himself, but he's going to get his perspective on this shifted just a little bit in this episode. Yes, he still feels guilty afterwards, but he begins to see what John chose and what John did from a different perspective and in a different way. He's still angry about it, but he kind of begins to understand it a little bit. And we'll talk about that more when we get there. Another interesting casting side we have is for George Darrow, the man who originally summoned this demon 10 years ago and felt guilty because while it was there, the demon made deals with multiple other people who are now suffering because of his bad choice in summoning this demon. So even though he didn't get what he really wanted out of his demon deal and now he's going to hell, he feels like he deserves that punishment because of the other people who he entrapped unknowingly into this deal as well. So it just seems like he got the worst end of the whole bargain regardless. But he's the man who teaches them about goofer dust. In the writer's draft script, Sarah had introduced several other concepts that were ditched and just left out entirely. One of them was some sort of demon sit mojo bag that was supposed to be how Dean entrapped the demon in the end, that she was supposed to sit down on a table under which was carved an X, like a hoodoo X, with these mojo bags suspended from the four corners that would basically glue her in place. And they decided they would rather just stick with the lore they already had about demon traps, which, you know, becomes a standard thing in Supernatural, the use of demon traps to trap demons. They lost out on this other particular type of way to trap a demon. Honestly, I think the demon traps they've already got are probably just fine. But the concept is there in the writing room anyways of these mojo bags or hex bags, as they get referred to a lot also, that can have these sorts of magical properties that can trap or injure or whatever a demon. Because we'll see that used in much later canon by various witches, including Rowena herself. And the first episode where we really meet her, girls, 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 she has a hex bag that she uses to kill demons or choke them out or whatever happens to that demon who just basically collapses on the floor at Raoul's girls. Regardless, that concept is still something that gets carried along in the back of the writers' minds as the series goes on, that maybe mojo bags or hex bags can trouble demons after all. But it was removed from this script. Another interesting thing that we notice in this is above George's door frame, he has a devil's shoestring to keep out. He's got all the stuff set up to keep out the hellhounds just until he can finish his final piece of art. But the devil's shoestring will come back into play at the end of season 3 when Dean goes to see Bella in episode 15 of season 3 when she is taken by hellhounds. She had devil's shoestring up over her door, and that's how Dean recognized it, because George had devil's shoestring. And in this script, it's actually something in the casting sides, it's script, it's something they actually talk about. And he explains how it works to them, and he gives them the basic understanding of hoodoo magic that they will use throughout the series, like things like this. But that's where Dean recognized that from. It wasn't just a random thing, but George had it above his doorway too. The other casting sides we have are for the Robert Johnson character. The only interesting thing that I found in those is that it does specifically say that he made his deal in 1928. And I believe the Chiron on the episode or somewhere says that it's 1930 when he makes his deal. And that just is obviously a mistype from the script itself that actually says 1928. Because we know his deal comes paid in 1938. It's not an 8-year deal. It's a 10-year deal. So whoever entered the Chiron information just got it wrong. So we can dismiss that for whatever reason they made it 1930 and didn't think about the whole 10-year deal thing, because this is the first episode that really introduces the concept of a set 10 years on your demon deals. That before this, we didn't really have any demon deals other than John's that was payable immediately. And we didn't have any other crossroad. This is our first introduction to the concept of a specific crossroads demon who makes these sorts of deals. This establishes that 10-year period. So it really should have been that he made his deal in 1928 instead of 1930. And I don't know why someone changed that. For the Chiron, like, maybe they knew of something in Robert Johnson's actual life, and they were like, well, that time frame doesn't line up, so we're going to change it to 1930, not understanding that the 10-year deal was the key here, and that's why the deal had to be made in 1928. But whatever, for whatever reason, that was changed before airing. So I've just decided to hand wave that and assume that whoever typed that information into the screen just made it oopsie, because that makes everything make sense. The other interesting thing is that it is scripted, that, you know, we see all the other victims of the Crossroads Demon deal coming due. We see them being torn apart by hellhounds, and we even see Robert Johnson being chased by hellhounds, but they don't tear him apart. That he dies basically of something that resembles a seizure, and people at the time thought he had a seizure or he was poisoned or something like that. But, you know, he insisted it was dogs. There's also a lot of fascinating character or actor reuse from this episode into the future. There's a few who you wouldn't notice were the same actress. Like, the doctor is one of the witches in The Bad Seed. The actor who plays Evan Hudson, the man who's sold his soul to save his wife's life, he comes back to play Viggo in 8'10", torn and frayed. He's the demon that's assisting Crowley in torturing Samandriel, and the one who Sam and Dean kill before he can tell them that he has information that can help them. Like, he knows about the angel tablet and that's what they're really looking for. That would have been really helpful information at that point. It would have helped them at least understand why Cass is being squirrely with them. There's an angel tablet. The actress who plays Robert Johnson's Crossroad demon was in Hookman. She played, what's her name? Lori, her roommate, who goes out and gets herself murdered by the Hookman. And, of course, Alex Ponovic, who plays the architect's friend. I guess he's an architect as well here. But we all know him better as Gunnar Lawless. Same actor, just 10 years apart. He's also in All Dogs Go to Heaven. He plays one of the Skinwalkers. But since I always forget that episode exists, I'm just mentioning it because it exists. I was just reminded it exists again. But, kind of, who cares? I think that's about all for the behind the scenes details and stuff of this episode. So we're going to move into the then segment, which opens on a shot of John's funeral pyre. So we're dragging him back from the grave again to talk about him. Dean then leads with his saving people and hunting things, the family business. Saving people is again the shot from Scarecrow, where he's in the apple orchard with protectively standing in front of two innocent people. The hunting things is rather traumatically. It's Sam and Dean when they were shooting the Striga, which that was all flashbacks to Dean's childhood guilt over not being able to kill it the first time around and now having to save Sam from it again. So, yay. What a grand memory to bring up again. The whole next segment of the then segment is all about starting with the semi hitting the Impala at the end of season one and John's whole deal with Azazel in 2-1. And then it moves on to Bobby telling them about the Key of Solomon that we saw them use on Meg, just to explain to us, the audience, to remind us that, yes, they do have a way to contain and trap demons. And then we get our now, which is actually then, because it's Greenwood, Mississippi in August of 1938. Definitely not now. This was a long time ago. Robert Johnson is in a bar, cafe place, sitting up on stage, playing his guitar, ironically playing Hellhound on My Trail. I mean, doesn't get more on the nose than that. He's playing his concert and everybody's appreciating it, and he all of a sudden hears growling, barking noises. He stops and he tries to start playing again, and everybody starting to look concerned when he stops the second time, and he starts seeing black shadows pass across the windows. Their growling intensifies and he gets up, runs out of the place, and everybody is very concerned for him at this point, but he starts walking away through the woods like he's walking home, and he hears dogs again, and apparently he can see them because he looks over at one, and then he drops his guitar and just runs the rest of the way home and barricades himself inside. By the time his friends catch up with him, he's lying on the floor like having a seizure, and he just says, "Dogs, black dogs." The woman who's trying to save his life, she sent the other people to get a doctor. He sees the cross dangling around her neck and his eyes go wide and he dies. So the black dogs have taken him, but there was no tearing apart of him. So he kind of lucked out on that one. In the writer's draft script, it suggested that he had a bottle in his hand, like an empty bottle that rolled away. So maybe he took some poison. He poisoned himself to stop the dogs from coming after him. But then we've reached the title card, and now we're back to the present. Sam and Dean are in some random diner, and Sam is on his laptop, upset because he's got Dean's official warrants for his arrest up on the screen, And he's upset now that Dean is wanted for murder in St. Louis, and he's officially in the federal database of wanted felons. And Sam doesn't have any criminal record attached. Somehow they lucked out on him getting even accessory, and Dean's like, "Hi, you're jealous, you know?" And Sam's like, "No, I'm not. This is going to make our lives harder. We can't just walk around freely anymore because somebody might recognize you from the wanted posters, you know, like you can't pretend to be FBI because they could recognize you." But at this point, Dean finds it slightly hilarious because he hasn't had to live with it under that ridiculous halfway in hiding mode that he will get into later in this season. To him right now, this is just entertaining. Or he puts on a show that it's entertaining because he's kind of stuck with it regardless. And remember, if you will, that the only reason he ever got on the police radar in the first place was because Sam asked him to help their friend and the shapeshifter creature. And he lied to their friend about what they were doing, how they were going about things. And that painted a target on them by the shapeshifter way back in Skin. We're talking here, season 1, episode 6. None of this is Dean's fault that he's on the police radar for any of this. It's just is what it is. And yet Sam sort of blames Dean for it. And that always bothers me. Sam describes the case of the architect who plunged to his death 2 days after reporting that there were big black wild dogs in his apartment building, like in the penthouse suite of this apartment building. And they were after him. He doesn't report in for 2 more days after that and then takes a swan dive off the roof. So again, he's not torn apart by the hellhounds. He takes his own life. So I guess that's always an option, like Robert Johnson, if he had downed a bottle of poison to get the black dogs from off his tail, or, you know, the hellhounds, or jump off your roof, or like Dean will offer to Gunnar Lawless far into the future. He offers him the out of shooting himself before the hellhounds come after him. So there is a kinder, gentler way to go rather than just be ripped apart. You could choose your moment and choose your method, which still is effectively the same, but at least it spares you having to die like that. So Sam describes the lore on black dogs, that they may be animal spirits or just death omens, but there's different lore, different creatures from all over the world. They're not actually dealing with black dogs. The show never actually does deal with an actual black dog. We only get the hellhounds. Dean, of course, has to get the joke in about the giant black dog humping your leg. So he thinks it's funny. At least he does for the moment. They go to talk with the business partner of the deceased architect, who tells them this tale of how he became what he was, that he was one of the most lauded architects in the last 10 years. But before that, he'd been a bartender. He couldn't have designed a pup tent, he says. He'd been a bartender at Lloyd's Bar. And then all of a sudden, he was just designing these most brilliant buildings that anyone had ever seen. He just, you know, talks about how it's always the good ones, the most talented, the most creative geniuses who die young. And that gives Dean pause for a moment. He's like, the concept that all these creative geniuses who die young died young because of Crossroads demon deals that took their lives after they'd been, quote unquote, given a gift of talent or whatever that made them great in people's eyes. And then they die these tragic deaths, or die young anyways, kind of does give one pause. Like, what did people do with their 10 years they were given? And sort of ironic that that's the same actor talking about how his friend died. In 10 years on the show, he'll be Gunnar Lawless, who dies the same sort of death after a long demon deal that he'd been under. So, good thing it's a different character and not the same guy, at least, even if it's the same actor. I just want to talk a little bit more about this character, this man, who's not even named in the script. He's just the dead guy's partner, the genius's partner. And he's like, well, you know, I'm a capable, but this guy's a genius. And it wasn't always that way. It was like he lived a charmed life. And now that it's over, he gets another tribute because that's the guys that Sam and Dean approached him with that they were doing a tribute to in Architectural Digest to his life and legacy and whatever. And he's like, yeah, he kills himself and leaves his family and me behind, and he gets another tribute. It's just, it doesn't make sense to him in a way. Like, this guy had everything anyone could want, and yet, by all appearances, he's killed himself. And then we know he made a deal with the demon for that talent and for that success. And everything he built after that was just his deal ticking down to when it would come due and his life would be over. But from everybody else's point of view, he was just this sudden genius who exploded onto the architectural scene and did wondrous things and brilliant ideas and innovations galore. And as life was filled with accolades and tributes, and then he dies and he still gets a tribute. It just seems pointless and frustrating to this unnamed man. The character doesn't even get a name in the show. He's just some guy who just happened to be the business partner of the victim of that Sam and Dean are investigating. That complete anonymity is like, has no concept, no understanding of why any of this happened. And it's just baffling to him. He's kind of bitter about it, that his whole life he worked just as hard as his partner and friend, and yet he never got the accolades because he was always second place to this other guy who sort of got his talent by dubious means and now has paid the price for it, but also left everybody else behind just to ask why and like what happened here. The tragedy of a life cut short that wouldn't have even existed without that tragedy becoming inevitable. The next shot we get is outside the Animal Protection Agency of Prince George County, where Dean is coming out after having talked to them about the report filed about the sighting of the black dog. And it's funny because their sign has a little icon of a black dog, but, you know, it's supposed to be the good dog because you can go there to adopt animals from the animal shelter there. Like, this is supposed to be a welcoming thing, the black dog on the sign. But yeah, not so much for everybody who sees one in this episode. So Dean flirted his way past the receptionist who gave him her MySpace address as they left. And 2006, her MySpace address. And Dean has no idea what that is. And Sam's just laughing at him over the fact that he doesn't know what MySpace is. And honestly, these guys, what on earth do they need social media for? Because they try and not have social presence anywhere, especially online. Like, in those early days, they want to stay under the radar, not post about themselves on it. So, and oh my God, I can't even imagine Dean going on MySpace. But they find out there were other reports of sightings of black dogs. So they go to check out some of those other reports, hoping nobody else has seen one of these black dogs and then died because of it. At another house where the dog had been reported, the woman who filed the report had left 2 days prior and gone who knows where, but her housekeeper thought that she had been imagining the dog because she didn't see or hear it, yet the doctor who employed her said she saw and heard the dog. The housekeeper didn't doubt her report because she wouldn't make that sort of thing up or imagine that happening because that's just not the kind of person she was. They find out she was an overnight success 10 years ago, became the youngest chief surgeon in the history of the hospital at 32, which is very young to be chief surgeon, but she had the talent for it, I guess, because of the demon deal, and now it's come due again. And Dean's like, yep, overnight success 10 years ago. We know a guy like that. But that he also finds a picture stuck on a bulletin board in her house of her and some friends at Lloyd's Bar in 1996. 10 years earlier, she was also at Lloyd's Bar, like the bartender who became the successful architect. We cut to a scene of her on her knees praying at the side of her bed, hearing noises out the window, a siren. And this is like not the sort of motel where you'd expect to see the chief surgeon of the hospital who lives in this fancy house. And you wouldn't expect her to be in a Winchester quality motel, yet that's where she is. She's obviously terrified of something. She's every little sound sets her off, and the entire room she's in is just decorated in reds and blacks, like the colors we associate with demons and danger in the show. One of the Toreador, the bullfighter pictures that they use a lot in this show, is up on the walls and just red and dark and clearly a demonic place. Finally, she hears a knock on the door and she's terrified. She thinks it's finally happening. It's finally going to be come due. But it's just the motel owner knocking on the door, telling her she's there past checkout. She needs to either pay for another night or check out. She stuffs some money in his hand, and as he's, before he leaves, his face starts distorting in weird ways. And, you know, we will have that explained to us, that it's a sign that the veil is going thin and you're seeing things, the hallucinations are starting, that this is what people see when they're close to the end of their demon deals. She slams the door shut in his face, and he thinks she's just some crazy lady. And yet she's having a little mental breakdown on the other side of the door, terrified of what's happening to her. Meanwhile, Sam and Dean are driving out to Lloyd's, which is out in the middle of nowhere, like a little shack out in the middle of nowhere, it looks like, at a crossroads on some dirt roads. The main Lloyd's sign out front is a Schultz beer ad, and we know that's the beer that's associated with debt and death. You know, right there, it's established as the crossroads beer that you'll have to pay off this debt and you're going to die to do it kind of deal. But Schultz is always a warning sign for those things in the show. Sam and Dean inspect yarrow growing around all the corners of the crossroad too, which is another necessary thing for a crossroads deal to happen. Rather than go into the bar to ask around about what was happening 10 years earlier, because, I mean, they know the bartender won't still be there. He jumped off the roof of his own apartment building. Nobody is probably the same as they were 10 years ago. So instead, they go to the middle of the crossroads. Of course, luckily, it's a dirt road and not paved. And they dig a hole, looking to see if anybody had buried a summoning ritual talisman, or whatever you'd call it, the box of things required to summon a demon. And they find one, of course. They identify the items in the box as graveyard dirt and black cat's bones. Dean describes it as some serious magic, like, that people are doing, like serious spell work. And it's funny, because how often during the whole show are they going to just become, this is like old hat to them, like the way that Sam thought it was funny that Linda Blair's character last week would think he would be upset about exhuming a body or whatever, digging up a body. And he's like, nah, that's sort of par for the course. Well, this is all still weird to them right now. This is powerful craziness going on here to them now. But then, you know, years down the road, it's going to be just as commonplace to them as digging up a body or whatever. Dean is already judging people who would sell their souls, who would summon a demon to make a deal. He's like, that always goes great. He's Mr. Sarcastic about it. Sam identifies the fact that they aren't seeing black dogs, they're seeing hellhounds. Dean's like, yep, wherever that doctor lady is, wherever she ran to, she's not running fast enough. Like, you're not going to outrun this deal. The hellhounds are going to find you wherever you go, because that's what they do. We cut back to the woman in the motel room, huddled on the floor, hiding behind a wall, her door almost shaking off its hinges as the dogs try and get into her. And all of a sudden it stops. And very cautiously she gets up and walks over towards the door to make sure it's stopped. And as she does so, the window behind her breaks in and the dogs come through the window and drag her back to hell. Not a nice way to die. Jumping off a building is probably preferable to that. Although I've never experienced either and don't care to. I don't know. She resisted. The other guy seemed to accept his fate and jumped. She didn't want to go. And next we get our mistaken Chiron for some reason that credits it as 1930, even though the script page actually says 1928, of Robert Johnson at his own crossroads, planting his box to summon his demon. As Robert Johnson's Crossroad Blues plays in the background, you know, the title track of this episode, we see him meet his crossroads demon, and it's the first time we ever see a red-eyed demon in this show. And that, of course, will become the signal of a crossroads demon for the rest of the series. We don't see him asking what the details of the deal are. It's like he knew when he made that summoning ritual and brought her there. It's like he already knew what all the rules were. Did he know about the 10-year thing? Did he know about any of the rest of the details of this pact he was making? You have to kind of assume he did, because he's the one who planted the spell and started the spell, that he didn't just unknowingly walk into this. But he chose what he wanted. He wanted to be the greatest blues man who ever lived, and made his deal, sealed with a kiss. He didn't even know how the deal was sealed. He's like, so do we shake on it? Or, and then she gives him a passionate kiss. We know demon deals are sealed with kisses. Sam's the one who brings up the Robert Johnson legend as what's happening now. And Dean's like, it's not a legend. You know his music. Sam makes a face, and Dean explains all the Robert Johnson songs about occult things like Hellhound on My Trail and Crossroad Blues, and kind of disappointed in Sam for not knowing his history as a hunter, that would be something that hunters would know. And then he describes how Robert Johnson died, that we saw in the opening scene. Sam wants to find out if there were any more people who made deals with the demon that they can save. And Dean's like, why? Why bother? You know, these people made their own bed kind of deal. Let them lie in it. And Sam's like, well, we can't just leave these people to die horrible deaths. And Dean's like, why not? They're not exactly squeaky clean. They made a deal with a demon. They knew what they were doing. They signed up for it. This is the consequence. He's really judgmental of these people for doing this, because he still knows in the back of his brain that this is probably what John did, well, not exactly, but similar to what John did to save his life, and that cost John his own life. He's still feeling the guilt and the burden and the horror of that whole situation, applying how he feels about it broadly to all these other people. He takes the picture out of the summoning box, because apparently people who perform this ritual are required to put a photograph or a likeness of themselves into the box. So Dean takes that photo into Lloyd's and asks if anyone recognizes the man. That leads them to an artist studio in a really rundown part of town. As they're walking up to the house, Dean's kind of shocked that he lives in this place, and you know, he hopes the guy traded his 10 years and the end of his life and eternity in hell for something worthwhile, because so far it doesn't look like he traded it for anything very good at all in Dean's mind. As they approach his door, they see black dust along the floor, and Dean's like, what's this, pepper? When George opens the door to find them standing there, he's basically telling them to get out. Dean's like, yeah, I think you reached for the wrong shaker. Usually when you're trying to keep something evil out, you reach for the salt. And George is like, gives him a second look, like, what? Then Dean holds up the photo of him from the box that he'd buried when he'd summoned that demon. And he knows that they know something about what he's done. He lets them in. Sam asks for 5 minutes of his time, and he gives them 5 minutes. His apartment is filled with odd hoodoo things and creepy things and bottles and symbols and skulls and weird stuff, but also tons of art, like incredibly disturbing, but really incredible art. In the casting side script, Dean is a lot more aggressive about George and his deal that he made, like a lot more blamey towards him, like, oh yeah, the deal you made. And then Sam supposed to elbow him, and before he says the quip about seen any hellhounds yet, and Sam then is supposed to elbow him really hard, and Dean's supposed to glare back at him in the script. So it's a totally different tone for Dean. He's more resigned to it at this point. in the actual aired version than he was in. He was still being angry man at this whole situation, not wanting to save these people. And this is where they get like hoodoo lessons in the writer's draft script, which is a lot more polished in the version that aired, thank goodness, because it reads kind of wonky from Sam's point of view on that one. So George is taking the full responsibility of having summoned the demon and everything that's happened because of it. And he didn't think about the price. Like, Dean asked him, why'd you do it? Why'd you sell your soul? And he's like, I was weak. I wanted my life to mean something. You know, who doesn't want greatness? Dean asks, well, you know, was it worth it in the end? Like, was it worth the price you know you're going to pay now for everything? And he's like, no. Like, his whole life, he's like, I wished for talent and I should have wished for fame. He's still broke and lonely, and all he's got is paintings nobody wants. They're great paintings, but nobody cares. He never gets to enjoy any of the success that the other people who were lured into this demon deal with apparently achieved. And even for them, their success doesn't really mean anything 10 years down the line when it all ends anyway. One guy gets tributes. The doctor at the hospital, she's going to have to be replaced and somebody else will take over her job. There's no greatness lingering there. And this guy and his paintings, maybe someday somebody will find them and think that they're wonderful and put them in a museum, but he'll never live to see that. He won't achieve greatness in his lifetime. Sam repeatedly tries to convince George to let them help him to find a way out of his deal. And he's like, you don't understand. One way or another, I'm going to hell. I brought that thing here and it hurt all these other people. They all were lured into deals. Nobody would listen to me when I told them not to make those deals. They're now paying for it. Also, they've died because of him. He's going to hell either way. He just is tired and he wants to finish his last painting and then let his deal come due. He wants to end it. And Sam's like, you don't really want to die. And he's like, just leave. I'm tired. I'm done. I just want to finish this painting. Then I can go. Dean looks at him like, what'd you expect? Did you think that he would trade any of it? Like, if he could go back and not summon the demon, I think he'd not summon the demon, but it's done. And he has to pay the price for that now because that was his choice. Everybody else sort of got lured in, but he's the one who made the choice and he's going to accept his fate. He did give them the name of one other man who made a deal that week he summoned the demon, Evan Hudson. And now they're going to try and figure out what on earth this guy could have wished for and what he got for it, if he's still even alive. We cut to a shot of a man sitting at his desk, and we learn it's Evan, of course, who hears a dog barking out in the yard and gets up, and he's really looking fidgety. Like, he knows what's coming. He hears the dog, looks out the window, sees nothing, and then his wife comes in. He's asked her to leave for the weekend. She's going to visit her sister. She's like, well, what are you going to do all weekend? And he's like, you know, not much. I've got some bills to pay, like paying back that 10-year deal on everything. As she's leaving, you know, he hugs her goodbye, tells her he loves her. And she turns and says, oh, and Evan. And then she makes that horrifying face that Evan hallucinates, her hell face or whatever it is that he's seeing, horrifying him as she's telling him she loves him too. And the look on his face does not match an I love you. It's a horror look. I'm surprised she didn't even notice his horror face after he saw her horror face she didn't know about. Ironically, as Sam and Dean walk up to their front door, there's a sign in the yard that says beware of dog. And yeah, beware of the hellhound. Evan just opens the door for them, and Sam says his name, Evan Hudson. Dean just bursts out with, have you ever been to a bar called Lloyd's about 10 years ago? And Evan just slams the door in their face like he's terrified of them now. They know who he is. They know where he made that deal. He slams the door and locks it, and Sam's like, any more bright ideas? So Dean just kicks the door in. Meanwhile, we see Evan scramble through his house into his office, and he shuts himself up inside of his office. Dean's gearing up to kick down the door to the office, and Sam stops him, like, holds his leg and stops him, and just gives him a look like, what the fuck's wrong with you, man? And just gently opens the door, like it wasn't even locked. As they enter the room, Evan bursts out from behind where he'd been hiding. And he's like, please don't hurt me. And they're like, we're not going to hurt you. Come on. We're not demons. Dean is already judging this guy hard. He's like, we know all about the genius deal you made, and we're trying to stop it. And Evan's like, how do I know you're not lying? And Dean's like, well, it's not like you have a lot of options there, buddy boy. He actually says buddy boy. So that tells you Dean has really judged this guy hard for his choices. Dean is getting really sarcastic with this guy now. When Evan's like, I don't want to die, Dean's like, of course you don't. Not now. Not that you got everything you asked for. What'd you ask for? Like, never need Viagra, bowl a perfect game. You know, just being really awful. And because he has no idea what Evan's situation was, or yet he just knows he made a selfish deal and it's going to cost him his life now. And he shouldn't have made the deal. Dean, in Dean's mind, nothing is worth it. Evan's like, my wife. And Dean laughs at that. He's like, yeah, getting the girl, that's sure worth going to hell for. Evan goes on to explain his wife was dying. She was in hospice. She had cancer. She had days left to live when he made the deal that she could recover and be healthy. And Evan's like, yeah, nobody twisted my arm. I made this deal and I'd make it again. He's like, I would have died for her on the spot. And isn't that exactly what John did for Dean? Died for him on the spot so that Dean could live. And ouch, this puts it in a different perspective, because Evan doesn't regret making his deal. He doesn't regret saving his wife's life and giving her 10 years of happy life with him. He just doesn't want to die now when he still wants to, you know, live with her and be with her. And he knows that's over now forever. But of course, Dean is still judging him for it, because that is what John did to him. He's like, did you ever think about her in all of this? How it would make her feel that you saved her life, yet you died because of it? What's your death going to be to her? It's going to be just as awful to her as her death would have been to you. And you forced her to feel that now. Dean basically gets to lay out his own emotions about how he feels about John having traded his soul for him. He's like, I think you did it for you. You didn't do it for her. You did it for you. How do you think she'd feel if she knew the cost of that deal? How do you think she would feel if she knew it cost you your soul for that deal, and that your soul was going to hell because of that? How do you think she would feel about any of that? Because we know that's how Dean is feeling about it. We know how Dean has her perspective on what it's like to be the survivor after someone who you care about makes a crossroads deal to save your life. He hates it. He thinks it's the worst. Sam pushes Dean out of the way because that's enough. That's enough. Pushes him out into the hallway, and they're going to try and save Evan from his deal. Dean's like, I got an idea. He hands the goofer dust to Sam's like, you take this, protect him as long as you can from the hellhounds, and I'm going down to the crossroads to summon that demon. Sam is like, are you nuts? And Dean's like, yeah, maybe a little, but what other choice do we have? Unless you've got a better idea, I'm leaving. I'm going to do that because we don't have any other plan. Dean suggests that he would exorcise the demon and send it back to hell, that maybe that would buy them a little bit of time to figure out a more permanent solution to save Evan's life. Dean obviously knows he just wants to talk to this demon and see what's up. And Sam's like, you're not going to let you summon that demon. I don't like where your head is at. And Sam brings up the similarities in how Dean's life was saved in exchange for John's, and a demon was involved. He's like, you've got to be thinking it too. And it's like, yeah, Dean's been thinking that for a long time, that John had traded himself somehow for Dean. And here's a perfect chance for Dean to get some answers on what exactly happened with John and why he's still alive. And Sam obviously hates the headspace that Dean's in right now, hating the Crossroads deals, and he's kind of worried that Dean's tempted to make a deal to save Evan's life. Like, just throw his own away because he doesn't deserve to be alive anyways. It should have been John there saving this guy. But no, it's Dean, and he's stuck with that. And yeah, his headspace is terrible right now. At least Sam acknowledges that. He's not dumb in this circumstance. But Evan hears the dog again outside. He calls back for them to come help him, and Sam goes with the Goofer Dust, and Dean drives out to the Crossroads, buries his little animal control agent badge picture in the box, and the demon appears. And she brings up, when she identifies that she knows Dean Winchester, she's like, I get the newsletter. That's the first time we get the mention that, oh yeah, there's a hell newsletter, or, you know, demon bathroom walls, or any of the number of references to the gossip mill that is hell, apparently, that demons do talk about Dean Winchester. Wonder why. Why would any random demon know this guy? They haven't done anything that big yet. You know, they were just trying to take down Azazel. Is that a big enough deal to put them on the radar of every demon in hell? Interesting. They don't yet know about the bigger plans afoot in the cosmos for regarding the Winchesters. But they will eventually, because, I mean, even the writers hadn't thought that stuff up yet. But it works in retrospect because of things like this. She'd heard Dean was handsome. I wonder which demon shared that info. Who put that in the newsletter? But Dean talks her into coming back to his car with him to work out their deal in private. And it's like, you're standing at a deserted crossroads in the middle of nowhere all alone. That's not private enough for you? Oh no, we're going to go to the car parked over here. And like, okay, I'll buy it, whatever. Need that extra layer of privacy. We cut back to Evan's, where Sam is pouring out a circle of goofer dust on the floor for Evan to stay inside. So in theory, the hellhounds can't get him. Sam explains what he's doing. He puts the goofer dust down in front of the fireplace, in front of the window, like putting as many layers of this as possible between Evan and the hellhounds. And Evan's just like incredulous that this is happening to him, but he's going along with it. It's not like he has any other choice. Back at the crossroads, the demon is talking to Dean, and he's like, well, I want you to release Evan from his deal. She's like, that's non-negotiable. What are you offering in trade? And he's like, me. She's like, well, like father, like son, willing to trade your life for someone else's. That shocks Dean. He's not surprised by the news because he kind of had been thinking it all along, but it's still horrifying to hear confirmed. Sam finishes pouring his goofer dust, and it cuts back to the demon doing the deal. And she's like, you knew about your dad's deal, right? His life for yours. And she says, going on about how she wishes she'd made that deal. As Dean opens the car door for her to get in, she sees something underneath the car and realizes what it is. And it's a devil's trap. And she's incredulous that he would stoop to such a ridiculous trick. Back at Evan's place, the hellhounds are trying to break down the office door, and even Sam steps inside the goofer dust circle. It doesn't look like a door that can hold for very long against hellhounds. Back at the crossroads, this demon is basically functioning as the Jiminy Cricket on Dean's shoulder, the self-recrimination Jiminy Cricket, I guess. Dean's like backing up towards a wooden structure. It's like a water tower. He tells her to take her best shot, and she's like, why would I? I'm not going to put you out of your misery. Your misery is the point. The fact that all your waking thoughts are about how your father sold his soul for yours and how he's rotting in hell for you, it just fills you with guilt. It fills you with misery that his death is all your fault. The demons tells him, you blew it. I could have given you what you want. And Dean's like, what's that? Your father. I could have brought him back. But you blew the deal by trying to lure me into a devil's trap. So now you get nothing. The demon starts to walk away as if she's not going to deal with Dean, as if he actually did blow his chance, and gives him just enough time to think about it. And as she's walking away with her back to him, we see her face when Dean says, "Wait," and tells her to stop. We see that her face spread out into a smile, like she knew he was going to beg. She knew he was going to call her back, and she is going to get to make this deal. She's just driving in the pain while she can. Back at Evan's house, the banging at the door stops suddenly, and Sam's like, "Do you still hear it?" And Evan's like, "No. Is it over?" And they hear another rumbling sound from an air vent, and the hellhound comes bursting through it. And obviously, it's made it inside. Dean's worked his way underneath. He's now standing underneath this water tower structure. And she doesn't suspect a thing because she's too busy running her own scam on him. That she walks over to the structure and is like, "You're lucky I have a thing for lost causes," or whatever, and comes back to talk to him. The demon gives him this whole pretty little speech about what she can do for Dean. She can bring back his father because he's supposed to be alive and Dean's supposed to be dead. So John can live out his natural life like he was supposed to. And Dean can get 10 bonus years with John that he wouldn't have had otherwise before he gets dragged to hell. She thinks she's got him on the hook. She thinks she's got Dean exactly pegged. And honestly, Sam thought he would have done the same thing too. That's what Sam was worried about. But when Dean said he was going to go out and summon the demon, this is what Sam was concerned about. That Dean would trade himself for John, just like John traded himself for Dean. As she's talking, she slowly walks underneath the water tower where Dean is standing. When she finishes laying out her little deal, she's got this look on her face like she knows she's sealed the deal. And Dean slowly turns and strolls out from underneath the water tower. And he turns to look at her. Dean starts making a snarky comment like, "Do you think you can throw in a set of steak knives?" And she's just like ready to make another comeback at him. Except she stops at the edge of the water tower. She can't walk out from underneath it. She looks up, and there's a devil's trap painted up there, too. Dean had really prepared for this. Dean lays out the deal he actually wants to make. Call off the hellhounds on Evan. Both he and his wife get to live to a ripe old age. And then he'll let her go now that he has her trapped. He was just using the whole bargain with his dad thing as a ruse to entrap her. I mean, he's intrigued by the concept, but that's not his priority here tonight. His priority is saving Evan. He's like, "His freedom for yours. Break the deal, I'll let you out." Gets out his book like he's going to read an exorcism from it. We cut back to Evan and Sam, who are struggling with this hellhound in the room with them now. It's clawing out gouges in the floor. So I guess Evan really does have a new weekend project. It's repairing the front door that Dean kicked in and now fixing the claw gouge marks in the office floor. You know, you have to rent a buffer for that. We read Dean doing the exorcism as we intercut between scenes of him affecting the demon via the exorcism. Back in the days when they still had to read exorcisms out of books. And seeing the hellhound slowly blow away the last of the goofer dust in the office, these quick scenes back and forth, like the banishing of the demon is the same as what the hellhound is doing somehow. The hellhound breaks the circle. Sam and Evan go running for another room to hide in. Sam's got them barricaded in a little closet area, it looks like, holding the door shut as the hellhound tries to break in. Meanwhile, back at the water tower, the demon's like, "Wait, stop." And Dean stops reading the exorcism. Everything goes quiet back at Evan's house. We cut back to the water tower and Dean is being passionately smooched by this demon. And he's like, what the hell was that for? She explains that's how we seal the deal. I don't know if he's right now thinking, oh my God, did he actually kiss Azazel? Like, John actually kiss Azazel? I mean, that's not how Azazel works, but maybe it is. Just don't know. Anyway, I wish I hadn't thought of that, but I did. So now you all have to think about it. Dean is like, I'd like to be warned before I'm violated by demon tongue. And he's like, how do I know I can trust you? How do I know you called off the hellhounds on Evan? And she's like, because when I give my word, I uphold it. She's like, you got what you wanted. Now let me go. And Dean's still holding the rosary and the book with the exorcism written in it. And he's seriously considering starting it up again. And she's like, don't you dare break this deal. You can send me to hell, but the second I crawl back out, skinning Evan Hudson will be the first thing I do. So all of this will have been for naught. The deal will have been put right back on the tracks, and they won't have any warning of when that would happen. It would just happen. So Dean knows better than to even just vindictively send her back to hell. So he lets her go. She's got to get in a few more good taunts on Dean, though, after he wasn't going to let her go, even though he did let her go. She's like, if you knew what your poor daddy is going through down there in hell, you would have made that deal. You know, people talk about hell and how awful it is, but she goes on to start describing it. And he's like, shut up, and goes for her. And she opens her mouth and the black smoke comes pouring out and she makes a run for it. She just had to get in the last word on Dean. And now poor Dean is just left standing there with the empty vessel, or with the woman who is like, where the hell am I? Like, what's going on? Because she'd been possessed. She has no idea where she even is. I guess this crossroads demon didn't let her see any of what was going on, like Meg's vessel. Meg was the vessel's name, not the demon. But Meg had seen a lot of what the demon had done using her body. This woman apparently has been completely oblivious, which is probably a blessing. But back to what the demon was saying about John and his experience in hell, and how that's a reason that Dean should have made the deal. It's like, well, maybe it would have gotten John out of hell, but then Dean himself would be back in hell in 10 years' time, suffering that for an eternity for that choice. And is it really worth it? Dean's going to decide that no, it's not worth it to get John out of his deal, that he'll accept that from his father. It takes him a lot to get there, though. I mean, he's pissed about it, but it's not like he can do anything about it. You know, trading himself doesn't make the situation any better. After it's all over, Sam and Dean are driving down the road, and Dean is telling Sam about what happened, and Sam's like, do you think the demon was lying about Dad? And Dean's like, you think so? Really? And Dean's upset. He's like, how could he do it? How could Dad do it? And Sam's like, well, he did it for you. And Dean's like, well, how am I supposed to live with that, knowing that Dad worked his entire life fighting against things like this, and this is how he goes down, by making a deal with it? You know, that thing is still free. The thing is still out there. And Dad's suffering in hell for me. It's not worth it. Dean uses the phrase, this was supposed to be his legacy, getting rid of the yellow-eyed demon, getting their revenge. And I hate that word in the show, that their legacy. Because, like, was that really what John's legacy was to supposedly have defeated this yellow-eyed demon? And then what? You know, he's taught you all of this. And Sam's like, yeah, how many people do you think he saved? And I don't know if John ever really counted the people he saved. And Dean's like, that's not the point, Sam. And Sam points out that Evan is alive because of the things that John taught them. And I'm just doing math in my head and trying to figure out what of that information John actually taught them that helped them save Evan Hudson. None of it came from John. Most of the demon stuff they've learned has come from Bobby, because John refused to tell them anything about demons, apparently, most of their lives. They learned most of that from Bobby and from, like, the goofer dust. They'd never heard of goofer dust until George, earlier in this episode, gave them that bag full of it. That helped them save Evan. Their knowledge about this crossroads demon, that came from their own work trying to save their father from a demon. So I'm just wondering what of this, I mean, yeah, he put them in a place where they were able to gain this knowledge and were trained to learn this sort of stuff. But like directly, John taught them zero of this information about fighting demons. None of it came from John. So even that's kind of wonky as a legacy there. And then Sam is worried about Dean because Dean is looking rather upset still. And he's like, when you were trapping that demon, you weren't really, it was supposed to be a trick, right? You weren't really going to make that deal. And Dean doesn't answer. And Sam looks concerned for Dean. Like, he thinks Dean just turns up the radio and doesn't listen anymore. He's tempted. He would have made that deal if he thought he could, but he didn't. And the demon even said, you know, I would have made that deal with you. You should have made that deal. And he didn't. He could have still. He could have said, yeah, let's do it. Let's make that deal. He could summon another demon right now and make that deal. But no, he's not making that deal. It's going to take something more than John and Dean's personal guilt over that for it to drive him to that extreme. And Sam has no clue that it's him. That Dean wouldn't make that deal for John, but he would make it for Sam. That may be how this episode ends, but for the first time ever, we get a segment called Soon, with scenes from upcoming episodes, which is a weird experience to hit when you're watching it on the Blu-ray, because it just says soon, and it's like the first shot is a shot from the very next episode, Croatoan, for next week's episode. And it's like, soon, yeah, I could theoretically just let the video keep playing and it'll just play next. Like, very soon. Like, it could happen in less than a minute here. I mean, it's too late at night for me to watch another episode, but hilariously, yeah. A little montage of scenes from Croatoan and Hunted, the next two episodes, that were a sort of promo teaser, I guess. They occasionally do this when there's going to be a few week break after an episode airs to give people something a little bit more than the usual 15-second teaser of the next episode. It's random clips building up the tension of introducing the concept of the demonic virus, and we know how that goes. Croatoan and Hunted both. It's a nice little engaging teaser, but I'm just going to save all of this for when we actually watch those episodes rather than try and meta on the little bits and pieces that they give us from this teaser. But it exists, and it's on the end of the episode, and I think they even show it when on the TNT loop. I don't know about on Netflix, but I'm assuming it's on Netflix too. I haven't watched this season on Netflix in like a decade, so except for the very final cliffhanger scene of that teaser is Dean and Sam standing by the river, and Dean's like, right before Dad died, he told me something about you. And Sam's like, Dean, what did he tell you? So we are finally going to get the answer to that. I mean, we knew that because we've seen these episodes before, but like 10 episodes into the season it takes before that information comes out. It really defines and explains all of Dean's behavior to this point. That not only did he believe that John had done something horrible to sacrifice himself to save Dean, now he knows for sure it's a demon deal, but this other burden of the information John put on Dean before he died, that all of this stuff about Sam, about the Croatoan virus, you know, he didn't know about the Croatoan virus, but in the next episode, when Sam is apparently immune to the Croatoan virus, a demonic virus, that he still has these psychic powers and maybe he's being lured back into that, whatever the demon did to him to give him these psychic powers. And Dean is finally going to have to unload this to Sam, and this just makes the whole season explode. That the weight of guilt and the burden of still having to be all of this for Sam and keep an eye on him and protect him, and he doesn't even know from what, but he's starting to worry that he might have an idea and it has to do with demons, and it's really not something he wants to have to think about ever, because it also explains a lot of John's behavior towards Sam over the years, that, you know, this, I might have to kill him because his demon powers, this whatever's inside of him. And we'll just talk about it next week when we watch Croton, because there's a lot of good stuff about that in Croton. Dean's guilty. Dean feels guilty. It's his fault. He blames himself for John's death. John wouldn't have had to sell his soul. He could have killed the demon and it would have killed John too, or Dean would have died if John had summoned the demon and then killed it. Either John or Dean would have been dead. Either way, every opportunity they've had to kill that demon so far, it would have either cost John his life or cost Dean his life. And John just made a choice and was like, okay, the demon gets to live, but Dean gets to live too. So frustrating. And then poor Dean just has to feel guilty about all of this. Because of course he does. He doesn't feel he's worth it. He's not the one with the plan. He doesn't want to have to be the one to kill his own brother. He doesn't want to be the one carrying this out without John. Like, no. No, thank you. He doesn't want it. And he's about reached the end of his rope with that. He'll be breaking next week. Tune in for more Dean angst next week. First season 2, episode 9, Croatoan, as I've said, been talking about for the last 2 minutes. Until then, you can reach me with any comments, questions, or concerns at MittensMorgul on Tumblr or SPNGeorge on Tumblr, or you can message me there, or you can email me at MittensMorgul@gmail.com, or you can join our Discord server. Either message me or email me and let me know you'd like to join, and I'll send you a link. Until next week, I hope everybody has a lovely week. We're actually getting autumn here. It's really nice. It's really getting cold. Overnight it got freezing cold. So yay, I guess. Happy autumn, everybody. It's a supernatural season, I guess. I hope everybody's staying warm. To those in the southern hemisphere, happy spring. I'm not going to be a hemispherist, I guess. Is that a word? It is now.